You can sort of think of it as an AWS-like hardware and software platform that you don't need to build that spacecraft to start with. Instead, you focus on the key things that you want to either demonstrate or test from a market standpoint, and then you eventually add to it.
The Interplanetary Podcast, the exploration of space for the benefit of all humankind. Your host in Guildford, England, Matthew Russell.
I am joined on the podcast by Dave Barnhart, the CEO and co-founder of Arcasys. Welcome to the podcast, David.
Happy to be here. Thanks very much.
Well, fantastic. Well, before we get on to anything about Arcasys, I actually thought it'd be really interesting to ask you what your origin story is. You know, how did you go from a young lad and grow up into wanting to do something like this? What's your journey?
Yeah, I appreciate that very much. I think I would argue I have an eclectic set of experiences. Other people might look at me and say, you can't hold the job down. But, you know, either one may be correct. I'm not sure. Caught the bug when I was a little kid with watching the Apollo moon landings and never looked back. So lucky enough to have done some interesting things, started some other companies along the way besides sort of being in the U.S. government and civil service and working on some really cutting edge kinds of things on the early days of what then was called SDIO a long time ago, but really cool technology, built some satellites, launched some satellites then. The first company that I was able to form was called Vanguard Space, and it was out of Germany, and arguably it was one of the very first space servicing plays, if you will. It was way before its time, which means we didn't get any money to go forward, but it was a heck of a lot of fun at the time. The second one, I was lucky enough to start with Stan Dubin, Millennium Space Systems, which did continue to go forward, and so that was great. And then in between a stint at the University of Southern California as a research professor, I got the call to go to DARPA. At DARPA, I was lucky enough to, after getting thrown out twice from the director's office and pitching a new program, the third time was the charge. It was picked up, and it eventually created one of the largest space servicing programs that is still in existence today. Under my rubric, it was called Phoenix, and now it's called RSGS. You guys can actually look that up and see that it's there.
Right.
After that, back to the university, as well as starting up Arcasys. So that was sort of in a short encapsulation, very eclectic.
Yeah, well, I mean, it obviously gives a lot of credibility to what I'm going to ask you next. Really, is so, what was the vision behind Arcasys? You know, what was the sudden moment where you were sitting there and thinking, I need to do this?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. There's sort of an inflection point. I truly believe it that has occurred, and. An inflection point in history is one of the things that most people don't see immediately. You sort of see it after the fact. Whether I was lucky or unlucky, I'm not sure. But having these experiences, and most especially the last one at DARPA, sort of began to show to me that if we really want to change and take that next step in space, instead of building monolithic things and throwing them up there with no way to modify or change, we fundamentally have to change that entire architecture. And what that means in essence, and the sort of the epiphany and the reasoning behind Arcasys was, how do I find a way to take that next step to enable sort of platforms or organizations or anyone who really wants to go into space, the ability to build after they get to orbit instead of making something monolithic on the ground and sending it up where it only has a certain amount of light and that's it. And that's, you know, the terms that have been used are next generation space or space 3.0. There's all these words, but in essence, what it means is we can now do things to platforms in space, whereas previously we have never been able to do it. And that's partly due to economics, partly due to technology capability, and I think partly due to there's so many people that want to get into this domain of space and taking that next step.
Well, what are the sort of big driving factors of that inflection point then in terms of like in terms of technology or politics or money, which is sort of, because it's quite funny doing this podcast. The one thing that kind of strikes me with space is the technology from the sort of 50s and 60s is kind of still how we get into space. We're just sort of making marginal sort of gains on it. You watch Starship and it's not particularly different to the N1, for example. It's successful, but it's, well, not quite yet, but it's, so what is this inflection point that actually is, because I certainly feel it, and it's something that we've talked about a lot on the podcast, is this sort of move into, yeah, like you said, manufacturing in space and getting things from being, instead of ridiculously building monolithic things on Earth and trying to do that stuff in space. What has caused this kind of moment in history where this seems like it could be feasible?
What's interesting is if you take a step back and look at an analogy that is similar that we might be able to get it, wrap our heads around on the Earth. One of them that immediately comes to mind is the PC revolution that happened years ago. The big guys at the moment thought, we don't see any need for personal computers. It makes no sense. But everybody else who was a tinkerer or an inventor or somebody who really likes to put their hands on things began to create an ecosystem of parts and pieces that were able to put together individual PCs. That just exploded in what could be done by, I guess, the democratization of the computational capability. What's really happening and that's driving things, I think, in space, are a couple of key capabilities that used to be the domain of nation states only or large companies that have now been driven down to as low a possibility as universities or high schools, if you will. The first of that was microelectronics, which bore micro spacecraft. That was sort of the first one. That was the first wave, right? So you can think about CubeSats. That's sort of the penultimate, right? The next is the ability to manipulate things in orbit that we take for granted here on the ground. And that translates to robotics. So it wasn't until, the space station has had huge robotic arms for a long time, but they didn't think about levels of manipulation and fidelity and dexterity until Robonaut went up. And NASA started to think about that. And at that point, at least there was thought processes related to what could you do with high dexterity robotics. Well, okay, now if you combine those two things together, all right, that begins to show we might be able to do things in space to manipulate, to connect, to assemble, whereas in the previous time frame where we didn't have the technology or the Moore's Law was not being taken advantage of. The third thing that I would argue is that from the economic standpoint, while I agree with you that SpaceX or some other companies fundamentally haven't changed the equation of throwing things out the rear end of a big cylinder and getting it up there, right? What they've done is they've followed the dollar per kilogram equation down as far as possible. So the more stuff you put up, the more mass, the lower the dollar value. Those three things together now enables a huge level, I would say an order of magnitude increase in democratization of individuals and organizations that are now able to think about testing things in space that they've never been able to do in the past. And with all that has finally blown up into sort of a really big system of inventors, entrepreneurs, new space startups that are really starting to think about, well, what if we challenged everything that's been going on, as you pointed out, from the 1950s and 60s, which is the way that we built things in the past, that now let's take advantage of the speed of Moore's Law to be able to now dynamically move things quickly, the ability to manipulate things on orbit after it achieves orbit, and three, well, now we have the cost profile to be able to get things up to test, demonstrate, and then eventually create. So I sort of see those three things coming together at one point.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose, Will, just because it's a hot topic at the moment, will artificial intelligence actually have a role to play in this? Because I'm just thinking with things like the ability to be autonomous. Because we'll get onto what Arcus is in a minute, but in terms
in being the
autonomous element of things manufacturing in space, because obviously often you don't have a human there, you don't have a mind that's able to operate. So presumably there's yet another inflection point coming in there, another convergent technology that's entering into play. Is that something that you're sort of aware of or taking into account or thinking of at the moment?
We are. It's important to distinguish between autonomous intelligent and artificial intelligence, right?
Yeah.
There is no question that if you take a step back and you go to the ground, you look at very large factories that are assembling things. They absolutely use autonomy in almost every aspect, from the supply chain all the way out to building the product and getting it out the door. Part of that is because it's much less difficult for the human individual to do it. And why not make something that's menial directly to a robot, as an example? But the other one means that you have repeatability in certain areas that makes sense from assembly or quality assurance, et cetera. All of that, however, is overseen by individuals who are basically programming all that. They have to make sure it works correctly. You are right that the very first instantiation of that type of an activity in space is not going to have, more than likely will not have humans next to it. So therefore, autonomy has to be built into it. Where artificial intelligence comes in, at least from my standpoint, is that you have to now tie together verification and validation and resolving errors in real time. Otherwise, autonomy is only as good as how the program is written. And if nobody's there when something breaks, well, then now you've shut your entire line down, right? So I do see that eventually, yes, artificial intelligence will come in. I think it's going to be probably another, I don't know, I'd say 5 years before we'll see the first instantiation of AI that's applied to an autonomous system that we think of today that has robotic capabilities to either manufacture, assemble, repair, service, et cetera, primarily because, you mentioned one word previously called regulatory. That regulatory regime for doing servicing, let's call it, in space is still growing. And in a growing sort of system of a regulatory environment, there's that naturally is going to have some inertia and be a little cautious before they say, yes, go forth and send out HAL to let them go do anything to us.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So now we've covered how we've got here. So what is the elevator pitch of Arcus? What is your uniqueness in what you're doing?
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, you have to take a step back and ask, well, what is the problem, right? I would argue that the problem is if you go to Spacetrack today and you ask to plot from 2020 to today, how many satellites have decayed and how many satellites have launched? They are about the same. What that points to basically is that everything that is set up today is built monolithically and it's optimized for one thing, and it eventually dies. So, well, what happens when something dies? Well, you lose the revenue, right? So our goal, in all honesty, is to change that equation so that anybody that wants to fly something in space, there is no end of life, there's no end of mission, therefore there's no end of revenue, because we have a platform enabled to be able to connect additional payloads, additional capabilities, additional functions to a space system, such that you can change the mission, you can change the customer base, you can change how much fuel you need, you can add power to it, and off you go. So we're fundamentally trying to change the equation from things that are built to die automatically to, no, we can extend their life, extend their capability beyond anything that people have thought of.
Yeah, so How does that differ to, say, if I was making a huge satellite and I was sticking it up into orbit, and obviously you've got to get the revenue from it. I mean, what makes your system different from, saying, me thinking, oh, what I could do is launch a system where I could fly even CubeSats up to dock with it and to attach to it and give it a bit more capability in the future, you know, just keep upgrading it. Well, you know, how does your platform actually make that happen? And I guess the question is, why don't satellite manufacturers do that today? Yeah.
No, very, very good question. Honestly, to date, and as you pointed out, you know, technologies that are a little bit old, because it's been difficult to get to orbit, because it's been expensive, and because, you know, space is still not the most benign environment to be in, satellite manufacturers have optimized their systems to, number one, last for a long period of time, because that's how you make revenue. And number two, they focused on a particular mission or market. So if it's a comm satellite, it only does comm and that's it. And it's made to last for a period of time. What's fascinating is Moore's law has not stopped. And one of the explosions that have occurred over the near term, especially in the small satellite industry, is they're able to now take Moore's law with all the computational and microsystems and infuse them into spacecraft. What does that do? That increases performance capability 3, 5, 10 times over what currently is up there, right? The challenge at the moment is that the way spacecraft are built are to optimize for one thing from launch. What we want to do and what we're proposing to put together is, in essence, you can sort of think of it as, in quotes, an AWS-like hardware and software platform that you don't need to build that spacecraft to start with. Instead, you focus on the key things that you want to either demonstrate or test from a market standpoint, and then you eventually add to it. That's not going to happen right away. You asked, why don't satellite manufacturers do it? Because there's no cost incentive for them to do it today. It's still much cheaper to do that on the ground than it is in orbit. Instead, we're taking a small step to say, you can test your technology, which they do today. And you know, our first market is, let's call it hosted payloads. Hosted payloads is real. People love to fly their stuff just to test it before they, you know, put it into production. Right now, the way that's done is it's put into a single satellite that is monolithic. You can't do anything else after it. It's a single use, single expenditure that goes up. So our challenge is, can we create a platform that people can actually add to their systems after they get to orbit, as opposed to building a monolithic system on the ground and then launching it?
I guess all the bits that you need for a spacecraft, a satellite, a functioning satellite, like cooling and heating and power and all those elements, obviously that's universal for whatever you're sticking up. But the specific test case, you just build the specific test case hardware and then dock it with Arcasys, and then Arcasys takes care of the rest of it. Is that roughly, am I getting it roughly right? Or is it a bit more sophisticated than that?
No, I mean, that's where, in honesty, that's where we want to get to, right? But the industry is not quite there yet to be able to have an assemblable satellite on orbit. And right now, the economics don't make any sense. What does make sense is you address potential needs of either organizations or architectures that can resonate with speed. So the fastest way to get into space is to be in space.
Yeah.
So what essentially we're offering is a long duration platform where, you know, we're talking to a number of companies that, as an example, they have propulsion systems. We just announced one with GateSpace. They have a jet pack. Well, you can think about Delta V, which is basically how much gas is needed to move between places, which is unfortunately needs to be quite a bit in orbit. We could actually keep those modules on our platform and then add them to spacecraft that go up after the fact. And so they don't have to launch it from the ground to go up. So what does that do? That begins to change their economic equation about how much mass they put into the payload, which is the thing that makes the money. They send it up, they come, and we attach to them the fuel or the Delta V required to go to a different orbit. So that's sort of one step, right? We don't plan yet to have a storefront, if you will, of all the parts and pieces of a satellite to put together. Instead, our platform really is meant to be able to increase the dynamic use of any satellites that go to orbit or any platforms that go to orbit in space after they launch. And so we're trying to actually do both sides at once, right? Is to convince the satellite manufacturers, put on some connectable interfaces, and then talk to organizations that have their little plug-and-play systems that can be added after the fact.
Yeah, so currently, what does the little steps, because obviously we took, I kind of jumped to the kind of, I guess, the bigger step that's further down the line. What are the sort of big challenges, and how is the kind of little timeline, how do you build your timeline up? So what's step one, what's step two, what's step three, and where in that step journey are you currently at?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So from a platform standpoint, we worked on from the beginning one of the more difficult things to do, which is to how do you get any payload, which if you break it down into a box, that box has different connectors on it, and that connector has different pins to it, and there's no standard anywhere, right? So we came up with the technology to figure out, no matter what connector you have, you plug into it, and then it converts it into Ethernet. So now we are able to standardize on any data protocol that comes out from any customer anywhere in the world. So we had to make the assumption, we're not going to ask the industry to change standards. We actually have that flying in space right now. So that little device, not very sexy, but it's very powerful to be able to enable us to service multiple customers from anywhere in the world today. The second step is the transport, right? I mean, this is sort of a fascinating problem. This is really, in some sense, it's not quite the traveling salesman problem, but it is a FedEx or DHL problem. You can get the ride from SpaceX, which a lot of people do. You get up to a certain position, but then you still have to make the last mile. And it turns out the last mile is not cheap, as we sort of all know, right? last FedEx we sent was pretty expensive. But that's critical in order to get customers to us. So we're using the nautical nomenclature. We've created something called a cutter, fashioned after the old sailing embarks, that really is that last mile transport, but it's designed specifically to dock with and connect with our port modules. So it's truly a holistic piece. The other thing we've done is we reached out to the OTV providers, orbital transfer vehicle providers, because we want as many DHS and UPS and all that to be able to come to us, right? So we've actually done the designs for that. We have a full-scale prototype that we worked up for that. And that's the thing that I'm currently working on that we're hoping to launch next year. The third piece then is the big port module itself. And that's the one that we're working on, all the software that goes inside of it. We've actually demonstrated connectivity with companies and payloads around the world to sort of prove that we can do this, at least initially. And then we're working all the details from the design standpoint of how to make that platform stable and maintain its capability to bring up payloads. Just to give you an idea, we have 60 different berths. Berth is a name we use for, putting a payload on, right? That could be attached to at any one time. And the reason we put that many on was, again, we want to make this as ubiquitous as possible for anybody of any size to be able to connect to us. The other thing we've done is we've worked on it, and we're working out right now, literally a full-scale mock-up and a robotic arm that is able to demonstrate having a OTV come up, take cargo off, bring it over to the port module, and then from there begin to assemble things. So we're actually stepping through use cases in 1G, out in space, in 1G, about what a platform could do. So that's sort of where we're at. We've actually had our first technology in space. It's there right now. Our first flight for the cutter of this OTV vehicle will be next year. And the port module, the plan is to be that in 2026 that would go up.
And so this port module really is the, How big is the port module, and is it something that you can sort of have several port modules together and build like an even bigger platform? I'm assuming you're calling it a port module because it's based on the fact that it behaves a bit like a nautical port. Am I exactly right?
I appreciate you grasping the analogy. Yes, that's exactly what we did. That's what we want people to think of it as: arrivals coming in, cranes offloading cargo, services occurring, and then placing onto another vessel and departures occurring. That's absolutely the case. So the port module, just to sort of answer your question, it's about 2.5 meters by 2.5 meters by 1.5 meters. So it basically fits by itself inside of a Falcon 9, if you think about it that. You can stack these things up. If you wanted to launch them, you know, together, you could launch one at a time. But the key thing that we've worked on really hard, which has made it difficult, is to do exactly what you said. Every port module, you can think about it as a hexagon, can attach to another port module. And when that happens, it means that we're increasing the capability for services that could be applied on that platform, not only in terms of surface area or real estate, but also in terms of robotic capability, the thermal capacity, the power available, the stability we provide, et cetera, et cetera. And that was done because, again, in the older days, folks were thinking about if you wanted to do something like this, you had to send up huge platforms. We're taking a different approach. The approach is basically following, if you can think about it, the human body, the biological approach, where cells are able to connect to other cells to make a larger complex structure.
I guess the closest thing that's currently in space, I would guess, is the International Space Station as a kind of place where you can dock, and I guess even CubeSats go to the International Space Station to be deployed in another position, and so they're sort of performing that function of a port, I suppose, in terms of what they do. So, and I guess the ISS has got, you know, has probably only got a few more years left. So does sort of systems like Arcasyst, I guess it's super timely. Presumably it's going to be pretty important that we have that kind of capability.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the ISS. We love humans, no question, but we are not planning to make this a platform where humans can support, right? This is truly, I would argue, infrastructure. You can sort of think of it as all of the things that make, you know, when you go to your hotel, you go to an apartment building, are working, you never see, but it's all working there, right? The ecosystem inside, to get to this space 3.0, right, to take that next step, there's going to be a confluence and a combination of human-rated stations, which will eventually replace the ISS. And so you've got companies like Axiom, Vast, Gravitix, those are all focused on, they want to apply people, which is great. And then there's going to be some sort of assembly or testing, maybe biological testing for new pharmaceuticals that don't really lend themselves from a safety standpoint to a human-rated station. And so that's where you're going to have, you know, organizations or platforms like ours that are going to be doing that. The other thing is that our platform supports almost any vertical in terms of what the market's thinking about. So we're agnostic to the application. That means if you want to do manufacturing, and we have one customer we're talking to about putting up a pilot plant, we can do that. If you want to do cell-based testing for some sort of new biological system, you could do that. If you want to assemble something, we could do the same thing, right? We really try to be that a platform as low cost as possible for folks to be able to take that next step to go from the previous space 2.0 to 3.0 to really begin to now take advantage of dynamic markets as well as optimize in space as opposed to optimize on the ground.
Yes, I mean, I'm just trying to think about what other space industries grow up around you in terms of, let's say, for the naming of it, we're in space 2.0 right now, and we're trying to get to space 3.0. other than that your systems and the things that brings, what are the other kind of space systems that are around that kind of make everything a little bit more feasible, adds the kind of economic justification for it all, in terms of, you know, if it's just a platform up in space, it's like, it's quite hard.
Right.
You can see that society or you know, the people footing the bill might not be too excited about it, but where does it lead? You know, what are all the other industries around it, and where does that lead to? I know it's a pretty crazy question, but I was just trying to get my head around, you know, what does space look like at the point where we have a few Arcasys systems up there and a few other different things? How do you envisage that?
Right. No, absolutely valid. So this is where you've got to, if we want to find that sort of science fiction future, we have to figure out how do we build and to get there. So to give you some examples, how we would change things relative to a platform in orbit. Today, every spacecraft has to have their own solar array to it in order to provide power. Well, there are some companies that are looking at, what if we could create our own power station and beam that power to a satellite? So you get rid of the need for a solar array, right? So what does that do? Well, that changes the economics for the company that's putting up that satellite in order to not have to have the solar array, which is a huge expense in order to get up there. The other thing about a solar array is it limits what kind of dynamics you can do on orbit based upon your size, right? So that in of itself fundamentally could change something. The out at the moon, as an example, or even at Mars, there you would like to have constant high bandwidth communication to go back and forth. Well, communication is based upon the size of the aperture. It still is, right? So one way to then accommodate that is you create a platform that allows you to build an aperture, you know, five times the size of anything that we've done today, and especially larger than what you can fold up inside of a launch vehicle fairing. So it's the platforms that we're talking about putting up are enabling changing the functions of existing satellite systems and how they work in Earth orbit. And then also they're taking that step in terms of the robotics, the micromanipulation, the ability to augment or add things to it so that you can now take that step even to the lunar system or to the Mars system that eventually gets to that, you know, the long-term vision of space.
Yeah, it does strike me that this seems to be a sort of more sustainable way of using space. And of course, that's a huge issue in terms of space debris, et cetera, and just the sort of cost, the environmental cost of actually getting to space and the industry itself can sometimes appear as though it's not particularly sustainable in a kind of green way, but is that something that's at the forefront of the thinking of Arcasys, that the kind of sustainability piece?
It is, and I mean that's getting to this shift in thinking where the current approach is you send things up and they're designed to die, which either they burn up in the atmosphere and start to spread aluminum all over the place, or you put them into a graveyard orbit, or if they die in an orbit, they become debris and become a threat, right? A shift then is to rethink, what do we do with that mass that was sent up so that we can either maintain it so it lasts much longer so you don't need to put up more mass, or you reform that mass. And so, you put it into a smelter, if that's what it is, and then you reform it, you 3D print it, and you make something else. So there's no question that one of the goals of our platform is to be able to support that ecosystem of sustainability, which right now is manifesting itself in debris remediation. So a long duration platform that is able to host any one of these remediation systems that companies are talking about, where you bring that dead thing to us, and then you run it through a cycle, whatever that cycle is, whether it's cutting up, melting it, remodifying it, adding things to it, and now it becomes useful once again. So from a sustainability standpoint, absolutely we're thinking about that, because many companies are thinking about, and that's another step down this path for 3.0, right? It's another one of those steps.
Yeah, so having, now that's explained, going back to your cutter element of it, presumably that's super important then, isn't it? Where you're able to, as essentially zip around the different orbital planes and inclinations to kind of try and get objects that, you know, didn't have the expenditure to get to the right place in the first place, or something that's now stopped. But my understanding of that particular physics is that it's incredibly difficult to do, and it obviously takes a lot, in itself takes a lot of power. Is there a sort of any sort of special technologies or special techniques that have been developed to kind of make that work?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I just sort of be clear, our cutter at the moment is really used from the Earth up and to get to that last mile.
Oh, okay.
We are talking to orbital transfer vehicle companies who, that's what they would like to do, is to go between orbits. You're absolutely right. The cost of gas, in essence, to do that is exorbitant, unfortunately. So what's interesting is when you think about the architecture of sustainability, there's at least two models. The first model is you create a servicer that goes to the satellite or the thing and then does what needs to be done. The second architecture is you create an ecosystem where that satellite or end-of-life element comes to the service platform. So we're following the service platform, but we've reached out to the OTV providers who all are also looking for that market for what they're doing, right? Mm. It's not just moving things up and dropping it off. It's potentially grabbing things and bringing it back that then could be something could be done to it. The other thing that's interesting is that just because of the physics, in all honesty, and just like here on Earth, you have to have multiple ports in different harbors. It's just the reality, right? So you can sort of think of orbits as harbors in space. So from our standpoint, we're starting out in the low Earth orbit harbor because that's the one where there's a lot of direct market for testing. But in all honesty, we are designing our port modules to be able to go way out at sea to the geo harbor if needed be, and anywhere in between. And so that's another approach. If the market for sustainability or for change is high enough in those harbors, in those orbits, then we would place a port there and be able to support that. So then that's a way to cut down the delta V required to go, you know, as you said, zipping around to try to grab things.
Yeah, I think I'd completely misunderstood the cutter. So the cutter actually is launched with your customer and takes it to the heart, to the port. Yeah,
brings stuff to us. Yeah, brings people to us.
In my mind, I had it as a little kind of ferry that launched from the port, a bit like a tugboat that goes out to bring in large container ships and drag them into harbor. I kind of had that in my head, but. So
it can. I mean, again, you know, it can, but in all honesty, you've nailed the challenge is the delta V. Yep. That is always the challenge, right? So we've limited the cutter. The cutter also, it serves as, you can think about it, when it docks with us, it increases the surface area for doing things, mm-hmm. or hosting payloads or assembly. The other thing the cutter does is that's the bridge, that's the structural bridge between when we connect different port modules. So Every kilogram we send up, we use at least twice, if not three different functions. It's the only way to sort of be economic and make it work.
Yeah. So once all this is up and running, what how do you envisage what the kind of most exciting things that then the platform unleashes into space or above the world or for the world? You know, what are the exciting possibilities that we then?
Yeah.
Gain?
No. It's a that's really good. I tend to think of the way these markets are set up as there's the Earth-focused market, which is really data, constellations, getting information to the ground. And then there's the new burgeoning in-space market. We're trying to sort of... And then the third one, the one that, you know, gets me excited, I like to refer to as the undiscovered markets. And really, that's where, if you have this capability, what can be done? And so the you know, things you can think about in terms of from science fiction. If you wanted to build a really, really large interstellar or interplanetary craft that's going to take folks up, you're going to do that in orbit. So in order to do that, you have to have literally the space dock, right? Well, that's starting out from an infrastructure platform. So that's something that would be really exciting for us to be able to participate in and support or enable as it goes further. Testing out brand new propulsion techniques that really require to be out in the middle of nowhere. So nuclear systems that would really enable now very fast transport to interplanetary distances. The idea of space-based solar power, that's been talked about for a long time. How do we harness kilometer-size collectors in space and then beam them down to the Earth? Forgetting all the potential safety issues and all that, but the idea to harness energy without having to use fossil fuels on the ground, that is only possible if you have long-duration platforms that have stability to them and have the manipulation capability to be able to literally grow and build things of that magnitude in space. So those are the things that sort of get me excited that we would be able to enable by having the port architecture up there.
Yeah, I suppose even just from the lessons learned of having any type of infrastructure where you're building in space, like even the first few times you do it, you're learning so much, aren't you, that it's the attempt of doing it. It's surprising.
Doing it, yes.
Yeah, I always find it very surprising how little manufacturing actually happens in space, if at all. I mean, at all, you know, it's almost something that you barely attempt. And of course, I suppose even things like refueling in space and all these things that are obviously going to be very important over in the next sort of 5 or 10 years, and it's in the short term, there's lots of things that we have to learn how to do in space, particularly autonomously as well, which I guess these platforms sort of lend themselves beautifully to.
At as low cost as possible and at low risk.
So in terms of your time at Arcasys, what's been your kind of, what's the most valuable lessons that you've learned in terms of running a company like Arcasys? You know, I should imagine it's very, very difficult where, you know, these are, I don't want to use speculative, but they're, you know, these are sort of grand visions that are very, very, you know, untangible for a long time. So how is that? You know, how do you personally motivate the team and motivate others to invest in you, and you know, what's the sort of most valuable lessons that you've learned from that journey?
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, I would say it comes in two forms. The first form is both a challenge as well as an excitement that gets the team sort of going. And that is, I'm a firm believer, and I was sort of educated in the notion of build a little, test a little, fail a little, if you will, right? Get right to putting hands-on hardware and testing your theory or your concept. So that the value of that is that we built a 1G test bed. And what's really interesting about that is, just like you said, you have preconceived notions about, oh, the robotic arm will move here and automatically connect to this and it'll all be perfect, right? Yeah, it's not. And so what that does is that immediately brings into us an understanding and to the team, oh, wow, this is more of a challenge than we anticipated. Let's look at it differently. We've got to come up with this new technology. We have to solve this problem. We'll work with our vendors or suppliers to say, hey, can you guys do this to make it more ubiquitous? So the team gets excited about that. We're learning a lot about it. The other thing that's interesting is that, as you sort of, it's fascinating, we use the word stakeholder. So we've had some success with some various government groups who've given us some seed funding, and they did it based upon PowerPoint charts, right? So, but when you bring them in and they stand in front of a robotic arm that's moving around, show them, this is how we're going to do this, lights begin to go off. It's like, oh, wow, okay, now I know what you were saying. Now I understand, could you do that, right? Could you do this? So it's really helping educate not only us from a technical standpoint, but also bringing in potential stakeholders or at least customers to say, oh, now I understand what we could do and how to change things. The second is the one that I always struggle with, and that's sort of challenging as an engineer if you're not taught this, is how to tell the story that that anybody can understand in 30 seconds or less, right? Because as you pointed out, use the word speculative. No question, we are pushing the envelope, but we're also, that's really where we really need to be. That's what gets me the most excited. It's the most challenging to convey what we're doing, but it's also the most exciting because I know what we're doing is literally at the edge of the wave. And if we could help lay the foundation for any of these other companies to make all kinds of things that even we haven't even thought of yet, then that's the goal. That's the excitement for me.
Well, I think for my last question then, because just following on from that is where, in from your perspective in the next, say, 20 years, what do you see humanity's future in space? What does that look like to you? You know, to map it out over 10 years, be as speculative or as fun as you like, but it'd be interesting to have your perspective on it.
Yeah, no, I do believe that there is a burgeoning station market that's coming up. So there are going to be replacements to the International Space Station, which means there may be more opportunities for more individuals to go into orbit. Over the next 10 years, absolutely, that's going to happen. It's not going to be hundreds and hundreds of people yet, right? It's still not quite there. But nonetheless, transitioning it from a nation-state control standpoint to a commercial standpoint will increase optimization and efficiency in a way that I think it's going to go a little bit faster. There is no question in my mind that there's going to be industry on the moon. And in order to get industry on the moon, there has to be infrastructure along the way. So that in and of itself, I think, is going to drive a number of sort of attributes. You know, the goal is that is peaceful activities on the moon. I hope that maintains and we're not in some sort of competitive environment, but you know, that's raised to be seen. After that, those two things, I would argue that between that time frame, there's going to be discoveries that happen or finally thought processes that we've never been able to test out in either new, very, very fast propulsion systems or power systems that would completely change how future spacecraft would be built, and that will be demonstrated on orbit. And from that standpoint, then we'll be talking about actually fast transport to Mars as an example, transport from the Earth to the Moon potentially, but that would go much faster. Sort of see that happening in the next 10 years easily.
Yeah, that's really interesting, the speeding up of, yeah, because it seems there was a bit of a push for nuclear propulsion, something that you mentioned earlier on. I see that as being the only one that kind of people know about as a sort of feasible propulsion to get to Mars quicker.
And
that's something I'm kind of hopeful that we'll see some kind of steps towards, because I think we will. It's very exciting times, so thanks very much for coming on and inspiring me again.
Pleasure. Yeah, no, absolutely, pleasure is mine, and I appreciate the opportunity to again, you know, continue to push, communicate and deliberate about what it is that's coming. You know, it's really exciting. Yeah,
I'll let you get on with your day and pushing the boundaries of space.